Welcome to MGO Podcast 12.26. Who knew the Big Ten liked the movie Highlander so much?
There can be only one.
For everybody still breathing, Michigan is into the Sweet 16 after an 8-point win against the LSU we don't know what to do on three-pointers Tigers. A game that was fairly terrifying in many ways. But speaking of terrifying, let's talk about what happens if you don't use MGO Blog sponsors.
Well, you probably just won't get incredible things like, you know, t-shirts from Underground Printing, who makes this all possible. If you check out their wide selection of officially licensed Michigan fan gear at their 3-store locations in Ann Arbor, or you can learn about their custom apparel business at undergroundshirts.com. Let's also mention our associate sponsors, Ann Arbor Elder Law, the Residence in Ann Arbor Downtown, Michigan Law Grad, Human Element, the Phil Klein Insurance Group, Information Entropy, the Raw Power App for iOS by Gentleman Coders, Homeshore Lending, who is once again sponsoring all of MGO Blog's tournament coverage. And we are doing this on Signal Wire, which I hope you guys are enjoying so far.
Yes, it's very sonorous on my end, so that's nice.
So Signal Wire is a full office remote platform that can be best described as Zoom, and Slack had a baby. It's got a D&D feature, which is not Dungeons and Dragons, but lets you step away and do work, but lets you keep you on hand in case someone needs your attention. So we're going to be playing around with all these features kind of as we go.
All right, so Michigan 86, LSU 78 in a game that felt extremely bad for about 15 minutes in the first half and then extremely bad for points in the second half because Cameron Thomas was hitting everything
at points
and Javonte Smart was apparently unstoppable on runners, and you're just like, man, this team has a lot of talent, like 1 through 4, and then, you know.
But that's literally it.
That is literally it. Like, Adai's got a couple of fouls in the first half and had to sit out. And then at some point, they got an open look from three. And I was like, who is that? And it was Eric Gaines. And I was like, oh. Because Eric Gaines is not having a very good season. I think he's shooting 18% from three. So this is a game where LSU has a total of 3 turnovers. They have 4 more offensive rebounds from Michigan, so that is a 13 possession advantage in possessions that actually get shots up. But they shoot 44 from 2, 29 from 3, while Michigan shoots 67 and 40, and that's enough for a final margin against an LSU team that was very game but not very organized.
Yeah, I mean, they are what we thought they were. I think we can pull that line out. This was extreme iso ball or set a ball screen, get a switch, and then I play iso ball. Thomas and Smart were brilliant at points, but Thomas started 6 for 7, and then once Juwan Howard put Shaundi Brown in the game, that really changed things a lot on both ends, both because Brown was on fire and he was able to contest Thomas's shots a little bit more than Eli Brooks and Mike Smith were able to do, mostly Brooks. And also Thomas just stopped hitting a bunch of ridiculous Michael Jordan turnarounds and stuff like
right.
that.
That...
that felt like more of it, to be honest. But I mean, having Brown on him at least helped, you know, annoy him on some of these shots, I think. And then, regression to the mean also played, I think, a pretty big role in this game, Brian, as you wrote in your column. That certainly helped a lot. And then for Michigan, this was just, I think, a solid showing of even though this team is currently going basically 6 deep with a couple other guys thrown in, that just having you know, six different guys that you can rely on to consistently produce points. Maybe not consistently produce points, but it's not like during different games, any of the five starters can blow up. And Shondi Brown can also blow up. And so in this game, you had Brooks and Brown go off and then Wagner go off in the second half. Whereas with LSU, once Thomas and Smart weren't hitting everything anymore and, you know, Days was in foul trouble and Watford just never really got into the rhythm of this game, they were kind of cooked in the second half.
Yeah, and you look at the rim mid-range three splits, and like all of LSU's extra shots came in the mid-range. And a lot of the stuff they were even throwing up that went down was very difficult. So Watford makes four buckets from the field, and three of those are like runners where he takes contact and then kind of comes to a full stop and is still able to make that shot. So Michigan's ability to contest everything that wasn't Cameron Thomas doing things that are literally uncontestable was impressive. And then LSU's ability to power through that and make a lot of shots that were difficult was also impressive. Not so much from a tactical standpoint.
we're not praising Will Wade here, but we are praising Cameron Thomas and Javonte Smart quite a bit for their ability to make shots. Those guys can ball.
Yeah, I thought that that Juwan had an interesting switch there. He just kind of moved Johns and Wagner to opposite sides. So when they were switching right every single time, they kept on getting both guards. Instead, they end up getting Franz all of a sudden. I was watching it with Matt D from Endless Motor, so I can't take credit for pointing this out. He, you know, he's got an eye for basketball. So he was like, yeah, as soon as they do that, you know, they're matching him on Franz, and it's way harder to get up a 2-point jumper, even, you know, if it's a 2-point jumper against
that
guy.
Yeah, there was some switching that was supposed to get Franz matched up after the switch. And this, I mean, there were some issues that, like, the bucket that Cameron Thomas got at the end of the first half, Wagner wasn't aware that he was supposed to switch onto Cameron Thomas.
Yeah, they missed that bad.
But so they had a couple issues there, but that was something that popped up. The one thing that was interesting to me is, so they put Brown on Cam Thomas kind of at the end of the first half, but then in the second half, he was on Smart almost the whole time, I think. And they were just happy enough to put Brooks and sometimes Mike Smith on Cam Thomas, and that was effective. So Smith drew a charge, and he got driven another time, and that ended up being one of those heavily contested things where Smith is in good enough position that you have to finish through him. And even though he's not tall, that's still a difficult proposition. And then Thomas against Brooks in the second half was not like Thomas against Brooks in the first half. So, you know, I had a bullet about this in the game column I just posted, where it's like, yeah, contests matter. Yeah, length matters. But what matters more is the kind of shot that you're giving up. And so Eli Brooks, for most of the year, has been really good about being able to force the kind of shots that, even if you're good at them, aren't really good. And the main exception is Dwayne Washington, for whatever reason, who just cooked him. But other than that, I think a lot of Eli you've seen is the kind of stuff that Cameron Thomas was able to do in the first half and then not able to do in the second.
Yeah, and I mean, this was a game where I think Orion Sang posted a stat where, you know, Cam Thomas, he started 6 for 7, but I think he'd only shot above 50% in a game either 4 or 5 times this entire season. So, you know, I'm really glad that Juwan Howard was willing to go back to Brooks in the second half in that matchup, because it's not like in the first half he was doing a poor job on defense. It was just, you know, dudes making shots. So being able to go back to that, and then also having Brown do a much better job just contesting Smart, even if Smart continued to, you know, hit some runners where you just kind of throw your hands up. I thought, you know, other than maybe I might have shifted a couple of the Terrence Williams minutes to Brandon Johns, although he worked the high low with Dickinson like we expected pretty well. But there were a couple times where he got picked out on switches.
Yeah.
And in a way where Brandon Johns has just shown that he's better able to stay with people. And while I'm on the subject of Brandon Johns, I thought he had a very good 27 minutes for somebody whose stat line does not necessarily leap out of the box score. He was really strong defensively, in good position, had 2 blocks. was able to kind of switch through players, and also was an important part of helping get LSU's front line into foul trouble.
Yeah, and he puts up 7 points on 8-shot equivalent, so it's not a blazingly efficient performance, but like he has a couple of open threes. He happens to miss them, but we know that like for the course of his career, he's a 36% shooter on, you know, I think of enough volume that you think that's a real number. So he needs to take those shots, and if he hits them, he hits them, and if he doesn't, he doesn't. But other than that, he was efficient. And more than that, like, so if you look at the usage distribution in this game, so LSU goes 33, 33, 20, 11, 8, and 7. Michigan goes 21, 22, 21, 20, 18, and 14. Brandon Johns is the 14th. But to have that be like the floor of the guys who played enough to actually to have KenPom actually give them an offensive rating just improves your ability to score so much. And Michigan was able to like get something from everybody in this game, which is something that LSU could not say.
Yeah, especially since, I mean, Austin Davis and Terrence Williams, the two guys who don't get enough minutes and possessions in this game to qualify for, you know, those stats. Those guys aren't exactly wallflowers on offense. I mean, Davis gets his usage because you kind of have to use him on offense when he's out there. That's what he's there for. And Williams is a pretty active player. And, you know, was 2 for 2 on twos in this game, had 3 assists. I mean, you know, I did want to see, you know, I did just say I wanted to see some of his minutes shifted to Brandon Johns because of the stuff on defense, but also teams aren't necessarily going to be picking out, you know, ISO matchups against Michigan like LSU just did. And I don't think Williams has been a particularly negative defender either. I'm still worried about spacing issues when he's on the floor, but he's doing pretty much everything he can to mitigate them by, you know, cutting really hard to the hoop. He got a great bucket off of that, and then showing good chemistry with Dickinson. So, this is a pretty good, I would say, tight 8-man rotation where you can rely on everybody to chip in something.
Yeah, and Michigan goes 10 of 25 from 3. Could have been, they could have had 35 wide open 3 attempts in this game. And one of the things that we were wondering about kind of going into the game is, was there actually anything to LSU's 3-point defense?
And it was the SEC.
Yes, they play in a conference that can't shoot. That's pretty much the beginning and end of it. So, you know, the quality of looks Michigan got in this game was absurdly good, especially because LSU was doing stuff like you occasionally see this in the NBA because the distances are longer and you've got more time on the court. So people like, if there's an open three, it's just an open three, right? That does not happen in college. And just seeing, you know, Smart sort of closing out Shaundi Brown and not even bothering to put a hand up was like, what are you doing, Will Wade? You don't have to practice the offense because the offense is just ISOs. What do you do in practice?
It's a good question because they really made like Iowa look like they give hellacious defensive effort. I understand to a certain extent, like, okay, you have an extremely short rotation with like basically 4 guys that you absolutely cannot afford to lose to foul trouble. So sometimes they're going to, you know, not necessarily contest, but like the analyst in this game, who I generally thought was pretty bad, there was one play where Darius Days just did not come over to help at all, and the guy is just trying not to call him out by name, but is just going like, what are you doing, dude? At least like wave a hand at him. Yeah. And I was getting a little upset at some of LSU's defensive issues, and I was happy that they were having
them. Well, I think that that contributed to like the Shaundi Brown game, because, you know, when you take Mike, especially when Mike Smith was off the court, because like this year when you've taken Smith off, like Michigan's offense doesn't create as well, right? He's Michigan's main offensive driver, and they didn't really need him to do that against LSU because like all he could do is like wave the ball at them and they'll freak out and then you get an open three. So kind of
Brown must have driven baseline like 4 times for either buckets or getting to the line, and like that's not something you see very often in the Big Ten, just free baseline drives where there's no help at the basket.
Yeah, this was like, kind of This was like a worst case scenario for a team where they had to double Hunter Dickinson because they had no other choice there. Their big man is 6'9" and also can't afford to foul out, even though he eventually fouls out. You know, Dickinson did a great job of keeping the ball high and throwing skip passes. And when LSU had to close out, I mean, not only were they not doing a good job of closing out on the shooters to contest shots, but they also were just getting blown by when they were doing it. So, I don't know what they do in practice, but they're talented.
There was one drive where Brown stepped out of bounds, and I think they called a foul. That was one of the phantom fouls. But like, I think he was expecting contact, and then like they show the replay, and it looks like he's trying to dive out of the way, expecting like, you know, some Big Ten defender to be there, and just nobody's there.
Well, yeah, this was also, we should get to the part where this was an absolute ref show on both sides.
I don't know. I rewatched this, and I kind of felt like this was just the players making it a ref show. Like the Dickinson fouls, they were fouls. Like, and
there was an inconsistent whistle and just some horrific missed calls. The Dickinson reach at half court, which was a very bad basketball play and a very deserved foul for him, comes right after he gets absolutely mugged on the boards. There is a Brandon Johns layup where he basically gets knocked out of midair, and then LSU takes to the other end for a bucket, and it's like, wait, what? Like, how? So, I mean...
There were a couple things, but it isn't...
There were more than a couple! I would say this. When national guys, like Eamon Brennan was just like, the refs in this game are struggling. And that was... When you have a national college basketball reporter just choosing to point out for no reason that the refs are bad, that's generally a sign that the refs are bad in a game, because usually those people don't bother to talk about the refs, because why bother?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I felt like I was expecting to be madder about it when I rewatched the game. And then I rewatched the game and I was like, oh, I guess that one was okay. So I don't know. Live, I kind of agreed. But then after rewatch, I was like, I guess most of those were fine.
Well, in a game where it's so intense, too, like every possession is so... It's like if there's 10 bad calls, it's kind of usual for a basketball game. But in this game, 10 bad calls is like 10 things that are going to destroy the universe.
That's fair. I do think that they have, and this has been kind of a tournament-wide thing, somewhat abandoned the whole verticality principle that had made early season games so much smoother and better to watch.
I think it depends. So there were a couple things where, like, the Terrence Williams foul on the fast break, where you look at that again, it's like, okay, it looks like verticality from this angle, but then if you look at the baseline angle, it's like, okay, that's not vertical. So... It's hard to tell sometimes, I guess, what I'm saying.
I'm thinking about the Dickinson and Wagner fouls that started the second half. I thought they were both real dang vertical on those. But that's probably more than enough ref talk, I guess.
I do have one thing that bugged me is that when LSU was trying to get into Michigan centers on like the top of the key, like they had a rule in there for that, the cylinder rule, and they were just... absolutely violating that. Just so you're able, you need to have enough room to like pivot and make basketball moves, and they were not permitting Michigan centers to do that. Like that's
while
like,
also hitting Dickinson with two fouls for trying to establish position in the post. That's well, the kind of stuff I hate.
Those were fouls. I mean,
so were the LSU ones. Like either call it both ways or don't. And I would much prefer they just don't. Just put the whistles away and let good teams play. That's what the tournament's about.
That's how you get like Michigan State foot basketball.
I mean, obviously, you know, call like flagrant stuff, but you don't need to call like guys establishing post position stuff. If they had let that Dickinson stuff go, it would not have altered how the game had gone, except for the fact that Hunter Dickinson would have been able to play more and play more freely.
Oh, yeah. It's just going to be the funniest thing in the world if NCAA actually like comes around and is like, all right, so you knew that this guy had paid Javonte Smart and you played him for 3 years and you didn't fire this coach, so we're going to nuke your basketball program. And it's like, you kept Will Wade. That's like, this isn't Bill Self. This isn't even Archie Miller. This is Will Wade. What are we doing here, guys?
Well, I mean, he's been more successful than Archie Miller.
I didn't mean Archie Miller. I meant
the other Sean.
Sean, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, at least he accrues enough talent where they can put a scare into a one scene.
LSU is just remarkable because every 4 years they'll have some guy who's going to be in like the top 10 of the NBA draft and they'll turn that into a nine seed.
Or in Ben Simmons' case, they will miss the tournament entirely.
Yeah,
in
man.
The SEC. In the SEC.
It's just, wow. What did Shaq do? What did Shaq do at LSU?
Destroyed Shaq everything. Are you kidding?
He was Shaq.
He was still skinny. He was horrifying.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, but like, what did they do?
They at least got a decent tournament seed, I think. I'm now going to be looking this up live, which is always great.
All right. Seth, put some intermission music in so we find out like what happened to Shaquille O'Neal in the NCAA tournament.
They were
LSU's not reporting information.
They were a 7 seed and lost to Indiana by 10. good God.
Oh my God.
And while Shaquille O'Neal himself was absolutely rampant, SEC basketball outside of Kentucky has always been rather bleak.
They turned Shaq into a 7 seed. What on earth?
That is almost more impressive than turning Shaq into a national champion.
All right. So LSU, definitely a place you could play basketball if you want
to go and do whatever.
Yes, if you just want to go play AAU in college, LSU is where it's at. All right, we're going to take a break, come back, start looking forward.
Okay. 2021 is finally here, and there's no better way to celebrate the new year than with some new gear. Our local friends at Underground Printing have all your custom apparel needs covered, whether it's breathable polos with your logo or new fleece jackets for your group. UGP works with customers big and small. Choose from their extensive catalog with options for every budget, including premium brands like Nike, Carhartt, Yeti, The North Face, and more. Underground Printing is 3 convenient Ann Arbor locations, or check them out at undergroundprinting.com.
Let me just tell you a couple things to keep in your mind while you're out there. When we take the field, we're going to win. We've got big goals. We've got big ideas. We've got to win this game, and there is no game on the remainder of our schedule more important than the one you're going down to the tunnel to play today. Now let's go. Let's go.
Underground Printing is proud to present the Bow Store. Visit us at our new location at 333 South Main or online at www.bow.team.
This is Matt Demrest, the owner of Homesure Lending. We're a local mortgage company here to help you purchase with confidence and refinance with ease. People don't get mortgages very often, so it can be confusing. We'll break down every single line item so that it all makes sense. And at the end of the day, if we're not giving you the best deal, we'll tell you to go with the other company. We're here to offer our simple mortgage guidance.
This is Seth Fisher from MGO Blog. Over the years, we've sent dozens of readers to use Homesure Lending, and every review that's come back has been raving. I myself used them to refinance after doing our original loan through our bank. I was amazed how much smoother the process was for our company. Complicated loan. Brian used them, you should use them too.
Finding out whether it makes sense or not to refinance or getting pre-approved to buy a new home is easy. Head over to homesurelending.com. That's HOMESURE lending.com/mgoblog to find out more. Or call us at 734-531-9950. That's 734-531-9950. I've got two of my favorite people here with me. Kind of an annual tradition. Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
11.
Colby, how about you?
9.
Can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue!
NMLS number 1161358, Equal Housing Lender.
I'm coming to the edge of the widest canyon, my companions dear. I'm starting to question my manifest destiny, my claim to this frontier. coming to the brink of a great disaster, and just has to be near. The earth spins faster, whistles right past you, whispers death in your ear. Don't pretend you can't hear. Don't pretend you can.
All right, Michigan draws Florida State in the Sweet 16. This is the only chalk matchup in the whole tournament left. The Florida State comes in as a 4 seed. They're currently ranked 13th on KenPom. And if you remember the Elite Eight matchup from a couple years ago, you've pretty much got Florida State's whole thing. They are number one in average height this year. And thanks in large part to the fact that Scotty Barnes is pretty much their point guard, and he is 6'9".
Off the bench.
And he's also the sixth man, and maybe the number six prospect in the NBA draft. Leonard Hamilton does weird stuff.
Right. And so they've got a couple of 7-footers that they play at center. They also play a 6'8", 260-pound round mound of, well, not really rebound.
Attacking closeouts somehow.
So they've got a lot of big dudes. They do not play anyone shorter than 6'4". And the concern, of course, going in is that we saw Mike Smith struggle quite a bit against LSU's size and athleticism. Eli Brooks didn't have similar problems, but I have a feeling that Florida State might close out occasionally. So this is, you know, I don't know if it's exactly a bad matchup, because one thing I started looking at Florida State's synergy stuff, and Balsa Koprivica, their nominal starting center.
Koprivica,
that's right, sorry. Plays about 20 minutes a game. He is like a sixth percentile post-up guy. So he is not going to be going back to the basket against Hunter Dickinson and trying to draw fouls out against him. So that's good. You kind of feel like if Dickinson does get in foul trouble, it's going to be stuff like offensive fouls and the occasional closeout on a guy who he probably shouldn't be closing out on.
Or hacking at a guy in the middle of the court.
Yeah, having watched... I went back and watched a decent chunk of the Colorado game, and also watched bits and pieces of a couple other games of Florida State. And one thing that jumps out both on film and in their synergy stats is that they are heavily reliant on transition offense. And Michigan doesn't let teams run. So, and they're also really good at getting back and playing transition defense when they get back. So, I mean, Florida State is a team that is much scarier when they're out on the move, because once they get into the half court, spacing becomes an issue.
Yes.
They don't have a particularly flexible or intricate offense. I mean, you mentioned this is, if you watch the Florida State team that Michigan played against in 2018, not only are there similarities in terms of the playing style, there are also a lot of similarities in terms of they bring their best player off the bench and they play a lot of 7-footers who maybe don't make their team better. Because I think, and this also comes up when you look at scouting reports of Scotty Barnes, there's actually a really interesting quote in Sam Vecenie's latest mock draft from an anonymous ACC coach. And this is always when you get the juicy stuff. So I'm just going to read this. Because this is ostensibly about Scotty Barnes, but this is really a lot about how Florida State functions. So as coach said, Leonard Hamilton doesn't really let his guys explore their games on offense. So it's hard to judge how good Barnes is at this point. We weren't threatened by him as a scorer unless he was out on the break. We loaded up to slow him down in transition, but in half court, we weren't worried about him. One thing about him, though, is that doesn't bother him. He'll take 4, 5, 6 shots in a game, and that's fine. If he's not scoring and doesn't see an advantage, he'll make an impact as a passer, and he's always pretty good on defense. He fits right in with what they do on that end. Their toughest lineups are when they have Barnes and Raekwon Gray as the two bigs out there, because those guys are as strong and long as your center, but they're also athletic enough to guard your guys out on the perimeter. That's where the quote ends. I imagine there's an extra part of that quote saying, I don't know why they play the 2 7-footers as much as they do.
Well, so I think one issue is that the only guy who's really a center on their roster or center shaped is Gray. And, you know, he's 6'8". So I'd have some rebounding issues or rim protection issues. Like, there's a big drop off between the 2 7-footers and Gray in terms of block rate. So maybe that's why. I don't know. One thing that's also, I think, good for Michigan is that none of the candidates at center for Florida State have any stretch at all. So Gray's taken 33s this year, and he's hitting at 27%. So go nuts, right? So they're not going to be able to lift him away from the basket. And, you know, as you mentioned, spacing is an issue because they really only have 2 shooters. Now, those guys are both hitting 44%, so they're extremely dangerous shooters. But, you know, there's always going to be at least one guy, probably two, who you can come off of on the perimeter. And Barnes is in that category because he is really not much of a shooter at this point in his career.
Yeah, that's the big question mark for him as an NBA player right now. And he's definitely a guy who's more, you're worried about him getting downhill. So I think with Michigan's ability to kind of, you know, plant Hunter Dickinson in the paint against this team, help off of a number of guys, there should be, I like their chances of shutting down Florida State's half court game. And then it's a matter of not turning the ball over against them. And they're decent at turning the other teams over, but it's not a huge part of their game. From watching Colorado, a lot of what they were getting was just running off of missed shots. And Michigan is very good at not letting teams do that. So that concern, I think, goes to the wayside a little bit. And then the main thing is not letting MJ Walker loose on the perimeter, or Anthony Polite, who had and both those guys are hanging around 44% on a decent volume of threes, and both don't need a lot of space to pull up. They're 6'5 and 6'6, so they can rise up over smaller players, which is obviously kind of our concern here. But with having Shaundi Brown as an option, and with Florida State's kind of spacing problems and Michigan's ability to get into passing lanes, I think there's a decent amount of hope that you can just kind of deny those guys the ball a decent amount in the first place, especially if Barnes is running the offense and you're able to kind of play off him a little bit and threaten and ask him to shoot. Meanwhile, just to check on the on-off stuff that you said about the centers, their defense does indeed get incredibly worse at defending the basket with both 7-footers off the court. So on point there. That's why they have them out there.
Well, the thing that really jumps out to me when I look at their synergy stats is there is an incredible gap between their catch-and-shoot proficiency, which is 99th percentile, and their jump shots off the dribble proficiency, which is 2nd percentile. So I don't know if I've ever seen anything like that before.
And yeah, I'm trying to comprehend that in real time, and it's tough.
So they're the best team in the country or thereabouts when they get catch and shoot looks, and they're almost the worst team in the country at shooting off the dribble. So
one thing that might play into that is that, you know, these spot up looks, are those specifically catch and shoot jumpers that they're 99th percentile at, or are those spot up possessions? Okay, never mind. That's crazy, because I thought that might also include attacking closeouts.
It's catch and shoot, but that wouldn't be a catch and shoot, would it? I don't.
They file not if they are qualifying it as a jump shot. So,
well, it just says catch and shoot half court, so it might not be just jump shots. Although they're 86th percentile on all jump shots, which I think is, yes, I think those are specifically jump shots, all the catch and shoot stuff.
Well, you made the point about the transition splits, and I mean a lot of what happens to them is Scotty Barnes, you know, he's not just a good passer in the half court, he's a good passer on transitions too, and a lot of those turn into kickouts where the trailer just, you know, hits a wide open three. So that might be kind of explaining it too.
Yeah, no, MJ Walker is feasting on transition possessions. He's 24-45 with a 63% effective field goal percentage in transition. So
this looks like a situation where if they get in a ball screen and Michigan's playing drop coverage, that's just going to be fine. So as long as they're not able to attack the basket and they're shooting jumpers off the dribble, like they are not good at that. If the pick and roll ball handler is actually shooting the ball, this is like the opposite of the LSU game. So
except for the part where they can hit a ridiculous number of guarded jumpers, because they are in the 100th percentile in guarded catch and shoot situations, which is insane.
But that's catch and shoot, right? So that wouldn't be off the dribble. So the pick and roll ball handler and you're pulling up, that's not what they do. So
yeah, that's
drop
true.
Drop coverage looks like a pretty good match for what they want to do offensive. You know, they're probably not going to be up over Michigan's shorter backcourt guys, right? Because that's just not what they do. And then they have some similarities to LSU. Well, they're Florida State, so you know what they do. They try to block literally every shot that's at the rim. And so they're very good at that. They're 11th in block rate, but they have their cost there, so they foul a lot, and they're close to 300th in defensive rebounding.
They also have a 7th percentile post defense as a team when you include passes. So that I would say portends pretty well for Michigan. And they also just haven't faced that many post-up possessions this year because, I don't know, I guess the ACC isn't a post-up league like the Big Ten. Not many leagues are. But that seems like a very easily exploitable area.
Yeah, so dump it down in the post, see what you're going to get from the 2 7-footers. And I don't know, that they do have some pretty intimidating two-point defense. They're 10th in the country. You know, one thing, they're very good at shooting threes, but they don't get to shoot very many of them because they don't have a couple of guys who are viable threats. So they've been pretty up and down too. Like, before they got into the tournament, they lost to Georgia Tech in the ACC tournament. They lost to Notre Dame in their final regular season game. They lost to North Carolina before that, and they annihilated a very bad Boston College team in between those two games.
I'm waiting for you to look up and note that there's a head-to-head comparison in which they lost to UCF.
That's right. I forgot about that.
By 12 at home.
They also took Indiana to overtime, which doesn't really sound very good.
That's the one I thought you were talking about. I remember the Indiana game.
But they also beat Virginia by 21 and, you know,
yeah,
just dusted Colorado by 18. I mean, Colorado away from Colorado is not as good, but that was still a pretty impressive performance upon rewatch, although one that was still pretty transition reliant.
Yeah, so Michigan needs to avoid the kind of turnovers that Smith had against LSU, where he's underestimating the length and speed of the opposition because you don't want to put these guys in the open court. Also, you don't want to get Raekwon confused with Raekwon.
Yeah, there's a couple.
They got two Raekwons.
They do.
They're spelled a little different, but they're both
one is much rounder than the other.
Yeah, you can kind of see the difference when they're on the court because Raekwon Evans is the combo guard who's, I don't know, he's pretty thick too. He's not a small guy.
But Raekwon Gray literally looks like Travion Williams attacking a closeout. It is a sight.
He looks like an offensive tackle. He's literally large enough to be an OT for FSU.
He needs to have some pounds put on if he's going to do that, but. He could be who is that guy for Michigan State? Who, the skinny one? I don't remember. Doesn't matter.
They're all skinny. They all needed peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Remember?
So like I look at this matchup.
Colchewins.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Very good.
Yeah.
I look at this matchup and I feel pretty good about it as long as Michigan is able to prevent them from getting up catch and shoot looks, and they're going to get a few of those, of course. But the threat that comes from guys shooting over Michigan's short guards doesn't really seem to be there.
Yeah. I mean, there is going to be some threat just on those catch and shoot looks. But in terms of having to worry about closing out on guys while they're on the move, there's not going to be as much of that. And one of the scary things about LSU was just how much they were able to space the floor for their players.
Yeah.
And Florida State decidedly, can't really do that with most of their lineups. And when they do go to lineups that can play more of a modern game, they haven't been as good on defense this year. In the past, they've been able to do that and play a pretty switchable, scary defense. But this year, that seems to have fallen off given the numbers when their 2 7-footers aren't on the floor. I worry a little bit about just their overall size and how it might affect Michigan's guards. This is probably not a game for Eli Brooks to lead the team in scoring again.
Right.
But I would expect a much more active Hunter Dickinson, and at least in terms of going for buckets instead of more being a conduit for the passing game to get kickouts, because Florida State probably is going to single up on him. because they have guys who are as big as him, but whether those guys can stop him in the post is another question entirely.
Yeah, I mean, they've only faced 67 post-ups for the year, so that's like two or three a game. The sample size here is not large.
Yeah, that's like 5 minutes of Hunter Dickinson.
Probably, yeah. So it's, and then like, I mean, Kopravica in particular has faced 13 post-up possessions this year. Now, he's given up 7 points on those, and that's very good, of course, but it's 13 possession against, you know, random ACC dudes.
They're probably so, all UNC.
Probably. Played two posts 100% of the time. They had 80 minutes of post, and Walker Kessler got 9 of those, and now he's gone. So that seems like a bad move, but but I'm not Roy Williams. So I feel fairly good about this. Like, Florida State is a little bit higher ranked than you'd expect. Actually, no, they're right in 4-seed territory. Never mind. So they're right in line with 4-seed territory. They've had a couple of impressive wins, but like the head-to-head matchups against Indiana and UCF seem pretty good. Like, they're not going to space the floor and lift Hunter Dickinson out of the center. They're also not going to test him on post-ups. They haven't been tested on post-ups at all. Like, I respect Florida State, but I kind of feel better about this, I guess, than I felt about the LSU game, oddly.
Torvik,
I don't
has
know if I'd go
10.
That far.
Yeah,
sure.
And Scotty Barnes,
maybe I'm just remembering like the first 10 minutes of that game. That's probably
I think that's probably sticking a little bit. I do think that this matchup, when you start drilling down deeper into some of the details of these teams, the more it seems like Michigan should come out on top of this one, especially since, I don't know, like, I'm also just inclined to think that even though, like, for as much as we've sometimes complained about, like, Juwan Howard throwing out some lineups that don't always make sense, given the gravity of the moment, like, Leonard Hamilton is the king of leaning on his bench at times where it doesn't necessarily make sense to do so. So they're 25th in bench minutes. Scotty Barnes comes off the bench as their best player. And I mean, if you're looking for ways to get an edge on the margins, and in tournament games, that tends to be what it comes down to, just having a tighter rotation where you're not relying on more marginal players might be what pushes Michigan past Florida State here.
Yeah, it is worth noting that Florida State doesn't really have the kind of holes in their lineup that LSU did. So they have a number of guys that come off the bench, but none of them are like, I have a 75 O rating guys, right? They're all
true
functional human beings who have seen a basketball before. So there's some justification for the heavy rotation, but
I mean, 10 guys this late in the season is a little much for a rotation.
Yeah, it's true. They played, they actually played 11 guys at least 7 minutes against Colorado. So
yeah,
that's like mid-season Tom Izzo trying to figure out if Foster Lawyer should get 20 or 25 minutes kind of scenario there.
Yeah, no, they really rolled deep. Yeah, I mean, this is a Leonard Hamilton. When I went up on Torvik's site and started playing around with the compare team efficiency tools, other Florida State teams from the last 5 years just keep popping up, no matter which filters you put on it. So, I mean, it's a Florida State team, and this year their dude is Scotty Barnes, and which is a little unusual, but other than that, it's a Florida State team.
Didn't Juwan coach under Leonard Hamilton at one point? I think there's a connection there.
I think he played under Leonard Hamilton a year or so in the NBA, so sort of. One thing to note is that Florida State is very, very good at defending at the rim. So that is something that will be something to watch for, because they're going to try to single up Dickinson. And if that works, then Michigan's offense could be in for a little bit of a world of hurt. So that's going to be a major issue.
Yeah.
If they can pull it off.
This is the closest thing I think we face to Illinois again. So it's another, you know, don't have that game
just,
again.
Just put Hunter Dickinson in the mid post and run dribble handoffs over and over and over again.
I'm okay with that.
Sounds that's like I watched that game and I was like, man, we could have done that. And yeah. Like now I'm like, before when Michigan hired Juwan, I was like, Porter Moser is not a candidate. He shouldn't be a candidate. Now Porter Moser, I don't understand what I guess they're. I don't know what Indiana's doing if they're not on the phone with his agent over and over again saying, I promise we'll change.
Well, when Thad Matt is available,
holding up a boombox outside of Boston's practice facility right now, but they'll get around to it.
They'll get around to it. Yeah. All right, we're gonna take a break. Come back and survey the carnage. I think is the appropriate term.
Passion for e-commerce.
Sell stuff online.
Security, performance,
conversion.
Beautiful user experiences.
Belle expérience utilisateur.
Monthly marketing.
PPC SEO.
Make your user a customer.
Conversion.
Eau de Parfume for online retailers. Love your website. Let Human Elements show you how. Available at human-element.com and find department stores, not find department stores.
Here's a thing people say. Seth, tell me about your insurance.
I'm actually glad you asked me about that because I just changed my insurance and I'm really happy I did.
Let me guess, you use Phil Klein and Owen Rosen of the Phil Klein Insurance Group.
They are MGO blog readers and they don't advertise during football games.
And they've got a 5-star rating on anything you would care to see. Call Owen at 248-682-7445 or visit them online at philklineinsurance.com.
If you get in foul trouble in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man on your bench. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458 or visit his website at michiganlawgrad.com.
Win or lose this season, stop into Information Entropy and make sure that you have a good time on game day. First-time customers can light up a free pre-roll and enjoy the quality cannabis products that this shop has to offer. Located 2 miles away from the Big House and accessible to ages 21+, find Information Entropy at 1115 Broadway, across from the Kellogg Eye Center off Plymouth Road. They don't want to hear the words go green over there, but they are happy to help you smoke it. Check them out at Information Entropy.
Get those flowers, man.
Ball player that's been coached by Will Wade for 4 years. Seth, give me your rawest take.
Rutgers is a member of the Big Ten Conference.
Oh, man. No. Off-brand. They didn't pull it off. They choked.
One of us.
They had a chance.
Everybody expected them in the Sweet 16, and they just barely didn't make it. They're one of us.
That was painful. I was like rooting for Rutgers, and I was like, "What? How have I fallen?"
That's how I know that we're all sickos, is because I was definitely like emotionally invested in Rutgers basketball.
I felt so bad for them too. Like, oh,
poor Geo Baker. Yeah. At least he got to play in the Big Ten, in the NCAA tournament, and win a game.
That's true. When you commit to Rutgers, that is not promised.
Ace, I need your rawest take.
People on Twitter should maybe reconsider using Oral Roberts stuff in their profile.
I am again not elaborating on any of this.
All right.
I'm just saying Oral Roberts fan for life is maybe not what you want to put in there.
I see. I gotcha. Mm-hmm. Yep, I gotcha. All right, here we go. Illinois has to give their Big Ten title banner back to Michigan.
Did they actually make one?
I imagine that they will. But you talk that much crap, and then you go out to Loyola Chicago. You know who didn't go out to Loyola Chicago in an NCAA tournament? Michigan. You know who's the only team left representing the whole conference in the NCAA tournament? Michigan. You know, we're talking about decimal points when it comes to, like, okay, who won the regular season championship? I think the conference tournament is an equal question. Because, yeah, Illinois won a couple of games. Does that really matter? No. What matters is beating Loyola Chicago and being in the tournament. So that's our banner, too. Cough it up, Whitman!
I mean, Loyola Chicago should have the Big Ten tournament title.
This is also acceptable. This is also acceptable. We'll make that happen. All right. If you would like to have us continue doing this extremely silly segment, check out Raw Power for iOS and Mac. It is an advanced photo editor and manager. Raw Power is written by a Michigan grad. It's great with RAWs and JPEGs, works with your Apple library, and adds editing features no other app has. Check it out at rawpower.app. All right. Now we have to dive in to the fact that Michigan is the only Big Ten team left in this tournament.
Can we use the old Big Ten? Is that back?
I'll allow it. Big Ten! So let's go.
Where do we begin?
Let's start with the least humiliating eliminations. Those would be Rutgers, Maryland, and Wisconsin, all of whom won their first round games. And Rutgers almost won their second round game. Maryland and Wisconsin kind of got run out of the building by very good teams. But, you know, given their seeding, given expectations, they were pretty much bang on, if not exceeding it. So good job, those guys. Do we have any thought about these three teams?
No, I mean, Wisconsin just kind of petered out in a way that was very predictable. So
how do we think Maryland fans feel about this season? They have this roster that can only be described as incredibly dumb. They have no point guard. They have no center.
But they were perfectly constructed to shut down James Booknight.
They wander into a 1-5 Big Ten record, and then they start winning some games. They ended up 9-11. They get a 10 seed. It whacks by Michigan three times, and then Mark Turgeon kind of loses his mind, and Juwan loses his mind back at him in a very strange. And then they beat UConn, get hammered by Alabama. So, like, okay, we made the second round of the tournament, and then Turgeon in, like, a postseason press conference is like, this was not a Final Four team. Everybody should be happy to be where we are. He's right, but he shouldn't have said it.
No.
In year 10. Have.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think Maryland fans should probably recalibrate their expectations, but, you know, they haven't. So,
So we met some Maryland dudes. I went to the first game, the 1-16 matchup where I blew out my voice because I hadn't gone to sports in a year and kind of had a lot of sports pent up. But, you know, walking around beforehand, we ran into all these Maryland dudes, and they're still very much in that ACC mindset. Like, their signs said, "Where's Duke?" Not "Where's Michigan State?" Not "Where's Indiana?" "Where's Duke?" And they were, I asked them, like, "You guys think, like, you know, wait," we went back and forth about the whole Turgeon thing, and they're like, "No, man, Turgeon, he knew his boys were there to save him." So they're kind of in that zone where, like, you know, this is okay. We kind of wish we could have better, but we're not sure we can.
Well, one thing that I think Maryland fans should be concerned about is that their recruiting is not what it used to be. So when they had been good under Turgeon, they have guys who are going to be first round picks in the draft, Bruno Fernando, Sticks. And they have guys like Cowan who aren't at that level, but are very good recruits. And then, you know, if you look at who they brought in this year, like, their top recruit was 82. You know, next year, it's kind of the same deal. Like, they're not getting guys in the top 50 range. And sometimes that's not a problem for certain coaches. But I think for Turgeon, like, given the offense he runs, he's like the Will Wade of the Big Ten, right? He needs talent, and they're just not getting it, especially in the backcourt.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the trajectory of that program. I'll put it that way. But, you know, at least you're talking a bunch of crap.
Yeah. And then Wisconsin's just going to be Wisconsin next year. That's a fact.
Are they all coming back?
Minus all of the dudes that this year, possibly.
No, they're all coming back. It's going to be zombie Wisconsin. This is...
yeah, I mean...
Where are they going to go? Jail?
Hopefully space prison.
Space prison. Just like prison, except they actually focus on rehabilitating you. The next least humiliating exit is Michigan State, because they were in the first four and went out to UCLA. But it's still kind of funny.
Were they really
very funny. But that's why I don't know why you're talking about a non-tournament team.
That's right.
That's right. Congratulations to the 8 Big Ten teams that made the tournament. Then I guess it's Purdue. Do we think that was less humiliating than...
I would say just in terms of the circumstances and also the expectations that is the next least humiliating of the humiliating losses, and this is a 9-point loss to the North Texas Mean Green.
Yeah, but you know, you just look at this team, and I don't know how they got a 4 seed, right? Like, I think the accomplishment of getting a 4 seed is remarkable given the kind of talent they have on this roster. Like, it's like,
yeah, I mean, it was Travion Williams, and he was only able to do so much in this game, put up 14, 13, and 5. But this was a team that was pretty much just the Jaden Ivey go do something offense by the end of the season when it wasn't running through Williams. And I think Ivy's going to be pretty darn good down the road, but as a freshman, that was a lot to heap on him. And that really came through in this game. And they also, I mean, for a Purdue team, they were not very good at shooting. And that kind of sunk them in this one because they hit the same number of threes as North Texas on 9 more attempts.
Yeah. Yeah. So they had Newman and Stefanovic, who were guys who in the starting lineup who were actually shooters. And then they were playing essentially 2 non-shooters at all times. And I don't know if that works when you're so like post focused and your posts have no stretch to them at all.
Yeah, Trevor Williams, he's always been like a good at bad shots guy, which makes you a little bit opponent invariant. And, you know, he was, I wouldn't say missing a lot of them. I think he was fairly efficient in this one, but it looked inefficient, and it felt like, you know, you should be able to dominate this team down low, and he was just still kind of taking his
jumpers. He had 9 offensive rebounds.
Yes.
Yeah, well, and he still only put up 14 points, right?
That's true.
those are him tipping back his misses and stuff, too. He was,
this is a guy who... He's a Big Ten center, and he's going up against the North Texas Mean Green, and he puts up 14 on 15 shots, right? Like, I mean, it's if we're talking about opponent and very invariant players, like, that's Travion Williams, and he shoots 53% for the floor. So it kind of puts a little bit of a cap on them next year, especially if he's going to be – they have to be able to devolve usage from him, right? Have to be able to find another couple of guys who can be 20% usage guys, because he's just never going to be that efficient.
I don't think it's necessarily about that as much as just is actually surrounding him with shooters, because he is an exceptional passer.
That's true.
I mean, I don't think the problem here is Travion Williams. I think the problem is that you got Eric Hunter going 1-for-7 as your nominal point guard, and he can't shoot and goes 0-for-4 from 3. You got, you know, whatever combination of Mason Gillis and Aaron Wheeler and Brandon Newman and I guess Isaiah Thompson that you want to throw out there. And those guys just aren't dangerous perimeter players. So
Newman is. He's the exception.
Yeah, he's coming into a little bit, but he's not a dangerous three-point shooter right now. He's not a super dangerous three-point shooter. I think they can be a better team next year because they have a lot of young perimeter guys who can grow. I like Ivy a lot, and I think that's their best hope for taking a lot of work off Williams. And I think with Williams passing, I mean, they can be a really good team if they have perimeter guys. I just don't know, beyond some freshman to sophomore growth, I don't know if they can fill out those extra spots necessarily, because you need all of those spots to be pretty solid when you've got a paint-bound big like William.
Well, it's going to be a crazy good transfer market this year. So, I mean,
I don't know if they're going to need it, because they're going to bring back literally everyone on their roster unless they have some transfers. And I think this is especially important for a Purdue program that kind of goes in cycles is that this year they were 327th in experience. So Ivy's a freshman, Edie's a freshman, Newman's a freshman, Gillis is a freshman, and then Ethan Morton is a guy who was kind of end of the bench for them. But they brought in a lot of freshmen. They blooded them. I think you can get significant improvements from them next year. I just don't know what the ceiling is for them.
Yeah.
But I think they'll be much, I think it'd be much clearer why they're good next year, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they somehow got a top four seed out of, top four Big Ten seed out of this team, so.
Yeah. The next least humiliating exit is Iowa, which did get to the second round by beating Grand Canyon and then ran into an Oregon team that, despite being a 7 seed, is top 20 on KenPom, and they just got their defense shredded, as it was always going to be shredded, which actually dumped Luca Garza out of the KenPom Player of the Year number one spot.
No way.
Justification.
Drew Timmy is now your KenPom Player of the Year, pending Gonzaga's tourney run. So they lose Garza. They lose Bohannon. Might lose Wieskamp. This might be the time for Wieskamp to go to the pros. So then you're looking at McCaffrey, Frederick. Keegan Murray will be a player. Mm-hmm. And if they get Jack Nungi back, he'll be a good center. But like, I think he just tore his ACL a couple of months ago, so he might not get all the way back. He's been injured before. That could be a problem for them.
Yeah, and this was a team where, I mean, they were obviously constructed to just flamethrow teams out of the building. And I don't know. Keegan Murray's an upgrade on defense over the guys that they had out there. Joe Toussaint's a defensive upgrade. but you start pretty quickly running into like, oh, well, we don't really have a shooter to replace this guy necessarily. And I don't trust Iowa to be good at defense, even if they have good individual defenders. So I mean, it always gets interesting when you have a team that's built their entire world around one player and then for years and then lose that player. And I mean, Wisconsin came out surprisingly well post Ethan Happ. You know, they got Micah Potter in there, which helped a lot. But they also had a lot more experience at the other positions compared to, I think, what Iowa's going to have next year. So, that, I mean, I anticipate a step back, although they still may be just as dangerous a tournament team because talk about opponent invariant. Not playing defense is one of those things.
The second most humiliating tourney exit, I think we're going to say Ohio State here, even though they lost to Oral Roberts.
I mean, are you giving them points for Oral Roberts being Oral Roberts?
Well, like, so I, if you look at Oral Roberts' profile, yes, they are terrible at defense, but just their two top guys are just nightmares, right? Like, I did not look at this before the tourney, but during this game, I looked it up and I was like, oh. You've got a guy who's shot 216 threes at 43% and a guy who's shooting 46% right next to him.
Yeah, those guys combined to go 10 for 22 on threes in this game, which is a pretty nice mark to have because nobody else on that team was doing much at all.
No.
But Ohio
Dwayne
State.
Dwayne Washington does not have a Michigan game.
No.
And that's it.
Yeah. Oral Roberts able to do this with four guys playing 42 plus minutes. Ohio State didn't go much deeper into their bench, but they at least kept their players under 40 for the most part, except Washington. But I mean, EJ Liddell was awesome. He just wasn't really getting much help out there from anybody except CJ Walker. And this was just kind of a, they were making shots and you weren't game, but against Oral Roberts, that's pretty embarrassing.
Well, I think not having Kyle Young really hurt them because you put Musa Jallo out there for 32 minutes and he's just a complete non-entity on offense and Young is able to get putbacks. He would have been good for a couple of, at least two or three buckets that Ohio State otherwise would not have gotten. And we looked at the on-off splits for Ohio State without Young and it was big. Especially
Young is way high up in a lot of the advanced metrics too, just based on a lot of the on-off stuff and his just overall. I mean, he's a very efficient player and a good defender. And we saw with this team just how much they missed having that extra presence out there, especially since he lets Liddell play more as a power forward instead of as a true center. And when Ohio State has to have Liddell as their main rim protector, and he was pretty much, he played center almost the whole way in this one. Zed Key only played 6 minutes. That's tough for them, especially in combination with Jallo not being a guy you have to guard. A little bit more of a foreseeable loss than you may think based on a 15 over a 2, but still a 15 over a 2, and we are going to get these laughs off.
Yeah.
I got a few.
I mean, for them, I think it's, what does Dwayne Washington do? So he's a junior. He could come back next year. I also kind of feel like this might be his time to go, just because, you know, he's coming out of a season where he was a star player for a very good team and has displayed an ability to hit a bunch of tough shots. And is he really going to get better enough next year to change his situation? So he might be a guy who heads off, even though he knows he's headed for the second round of the draft. But Liddell will probably be back because he's just 6'7" and a post. They'll get Suing back. They won't get Walker back. They won't get Kyle Young back. Arnes will be back. So you got to find some people to put around Liddell some shots, and then you'll maybe be close to the same level. I don't know.
I trust Chris Holtmann to figure it out based on the fact that I have looked at his rosters and gone, this is terrible before. And then they end up being a top five team in the middle of January. So
yeah, including this year, like we did not see Liddell coming out at all. We were looking at Kyle Young being their center and going, oh, these guys are maybe sixth or seventh in the Big Ten.
Well, the thing about Liddell is they beat Illinois and he went 4-7 from three. And I kind of laughed that off, like, right? That's just, that was a fluke. And then from then on, he was a 40% three-point shooter. And they already had really good offensive efficiency. And then after that, it went up like 4 or 5 points, which is absolutely huge, especially when you're already kind of way up there. So turning him into a true stretch really separated them from expectations.
Yeah, it's tough to kind of overstate his value to that team. Also tough to do it with Kyle Young, oddly enough, despite being on opposite ends of the statistical output spectrum.
Yep. And then the number one most humiliating Big Ten exit, Illinois going out in the second round to Loyola Chicago by 13, which
is the Big Ten tournament championship game.
And Loyola Chicago, that's like the biggest second round loss for one seed in something like 20 years. And the way it happened was just humiliating. So you have Krutwig just playing kind of in the high post, and they're running dribble handoffs off of him the whole game, and Kofi Coburn is just sticking in the paint, and they never changed that the whole game. So then Loyola Chicago's defense came into this game, I think, the number one defense in KenPom, or it's been thereabouts, and they blitz every Ayo Dosunmu screen, every single one. So he has 9 points. They just never adapt to it. They never do anything about it. He has 9 points and 6 turnovers. He ends his college career with a 57 O rating. And the Illinois fans I follow on Twitter are sort of fed up with Brad Underwood, which is a crazy thing to be after a one seed. But Illinois, if they lose Dosunmu and Coburn, it's like, okay, you've got Curbelo back. That's probably going to be pretty rad. You lose Tim Frazier. You have Adam Miller back. Maybe he'll be more of a factor inside the 3-point line in year two. Then it's like, you got Georgie?
And Jacob Grandison.
What are we doing here?
Yeah, and I mean, I can understand Illinois fans' frustration after Porter Moser just ran laps around Brad Underwood in this game. Kind of like Loyola's guards were running laps around Kofi Coburn in the paint. You talk about the lack of adjustments, and just, I mean, Ayo Dosunmu doesn't get to the free throw line in this game. And that blows my mind, because, it's not like Krutwig is the greatest rim protector in the world out there. And to not make any sort of adjustment where you get one of the best downhill players in college basketball and a guy who's probably going to go in the first round, despite, coming out as late in his career, because of his ability to get to the hoop. For him to only take 8 2-pointers and not get to the free throw line at all, it was just a badly coached game. And I mean, I don't think that says that Brad Underwood is a bad coach. He had done a good job of adjusting a lot of things earlier this year, including, kind of completely changing the way Illinois plays defense. But it does seem like he is a pretty heavy system guy, and when something pops up where it requires serious in-game adjustments, that can be trouble for him.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really question the team he put together or even how they performed. Like, they had a few losses, right? But they got a banner. They were within a hair's breadth of winning the Big Ten. Well, they had a banner, and then they had to give it to Chicago. And they got a one seed in the tournament, but then this game just really must leave a sour taste in your mouth, because very rarely are games so clearly decided on coaching matchups.
And it's weird that it's a 116 game that was like that too, because it's not like Illinois had to think too hard about their, you know, first game, right? Like, you know, and Georgia Tech was not expected to beat Loyola Chicago either. So you pretty much know what you're preparing for.
Yeah, you're not doing prep for that ahead of time like that. And I mean, you might have some advanced scouts on it, but you're not on that short a turnaround. You're wasting a lot of resources when there are two opponents to prep for, and you can't just assume that one team is getting through.
The thing about Illinois is, like, I don't know what kind of reinforcements they're going to get, because they have a couple of recruits in their class who are ranked about 100th. Those guys are not usually impact players in year one, and they're going to have to hit the portal pretty hard. Because all right, so Curbelo and Miller, that's a pretty good backcourt, but who is your front court? Are you going into next year with Georgie as your starting center? Coleman Hawkins popping up there? I don't know.
The Jazz man, come on, let's go. but yeah, I mean, they need some serious, sophomore breakouts, or, I mean, the portal just throws everything into it's just so hard to project teams for next year, because
yeah,
everybody's going to be in the portal. Who knows?
This is going to be the biggest portal ever, because there's going to be a bunch of people who have eligibility that just want to move on. So, like, it looks really bad for Penn State that they've got like six guys in the portal. Three of them are seniors who were going to be out of eligibility. Yeah. So they should have some sort of plan for replacing those guys. They just changed coaches after having a lame duck year. So they're going to be in a year zero next year.
Yeah, they're going to have a rough situation. But, like, I mean, you look at Michigan this year, and they're leaning very hard on two transfers who have both made a very large impact. And if we were talking about Michigan at the end of last year, Mike Smith and Shondi Brown never would have come up.
Right. So it looks like Illinois needs a lot of help. They are in a position where they might get it, right? They are a Power 5 school coming off a one seed with a lot of usage to go around and a couple of solid pieces. But, you know, if you want to come in and start and play 30 minutes for a Big Ten team, this can be it. So I kind of feel like they're going to drop off pretty heavily next year. But with the portal, it's difficult to make those projections until all the musical chairs have stopped moving.
Agreed. And maybe Curbelo is just amazing. Who knows?
Very possible. Like, yes, that's a guy who is a serious blow-up candidate in year two. Mm-hmm. All right. That's all the humiliating Big Ten exits.
Big Ten! Year.
And we mentioned Penn State. So comprehensive for all the Big Ten teams that matter.
Where's Michigan State finish in the Big Ten next year?
Oh, I'm actually getting slightly more bullish on them, unfortunately.
What?
Yeah, we're not going to start this material this early. Let's let the transfer market play out.
Save it for the offseason. All right, guys. We'll see you after a Sweet 16 game, win or lose.
Thank you for listening to the MGO podcast. I am Mae Sandbender, along with Brian Cook and Seth Fisher. I strongly encourage every other Big Ten team to continue talking as much as humanly possible. It is extremely enjoyable.
Can't believe Shaq got a 7 seed. What the absolute fuck?
Leave this in.